early in question time for this evening. It's nice to be able to put some of those questions down on pieces of paper. If you ask them during the interview time, they're very good because you get direct answers. But some of the questions you have in interviews are so good, it'd be wonderful if they're actually on pieces of paper. And that way everyone can actually share the beautiful questions with the wonderful answers, hopefully. But anyway, here we go, the first question. Some of these questions are really beautiful ones. You mentioned that monks with psychic abilities usually do not read others' minds or thoughts. Yet Ajahn Chah on several occasions, in his monastery as well as on one occasion in the car, read the minds or thoughts of his junior monks. Are these exceptions to the rule, or can it be that sometimes the junior monk's thoughts are so loud that they can be heard without having to tune into them? Your comments, please. Thanks. If sometimes, if you have like a relationship with a teacher like Ajahn Chah, then he may actually read the thoughts of his like close disciples, or you know, if a disciple is in a bit of a having a silly thought, then he might just do that to protect them. But sometimes, even with close disciples, is one of the stories of the great teacher Ajahn Mun, who when he developed that ability, he read the thoughts of a monk he was staying with, and the monk got so scared he ran away. And so you know, after that he realized that you know sometimes you've got to be very careful about reading people's thoughts. And afterwards, you know, really the person should give you permission, first of all. And usually if it's a monk like Ajahn Chah and he's your teacher, you say, you know, please, Venerable Sir, if you see anything in my mind which is inappropriate, please let me know, because you have that great trust that he will never misuse that, that he will always be able to use that wisely, and you'll always trust that he will use that for your benefit. But of course, there's so many inherent problems if you do get such psychic powers. If any of the monks here in Perth or sister develop such psychic powers, and it's quite clear they could read your mind, then you have Asya taking sister over to Canberra and using her as a spy. you would not need to have all these polygraphs and stuff like that. You can actually get all the information out of Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden straight away. So obviously, if you did have psychic powers, you'd be in big trouble in today's world. So it's better to keep it nice and quiet. Otherwise, you know, if you could read the future, everyone will be sort of trying to find out sort of who's going to win the next Melbourne Cup or whatever. You'll never be let alone. So it's better to keep all those psychic powers to yourself. And if you can levitate, if you can rise in the air, then the Australian Olympic team will want you to go to Athens. Come on, be a good Australian, just for your country. Get the gold medal in the high jump. So whatever, all those sort of psychic powers, they have their downside to them. And in the end, they just become like, you're just like a freak. And you go on sort of, you know, the midday show on Oprah Winfrey. You say, come on, in front of the audience, please, just rise into the air, just let us see it. And it just, that's all it becomes, because people actually, they like to see weird things and actually see strange things. And then all the scientists will put you on all these machines all day and all night, and you just become just like a laboratory rat in some sort of experiment. And this is what happens if you start to exhibit such things. So it's actually the Buddha said, don't exhibit such things. Keep them very quiet if you do have them. And then you're just like an ordinary monk. You're nothing special. When you're nothing special, you live a much more peaceful life. So that's, you know, one of the reasons why the Buddha said, do not exhibit any psychic powers. If they come, just keep them to yourselves. Because they take the emphasis away from, you know, what the Buddha was really supposed to be teaching. And in one of his great discourses, he said, of all the psychic powers, there's only one psychic power which I praise, which I encourage monks and nuns to develop. And that's the power to teach the Dhamma. See, because that psychic power, he said, that would actually help people. That's very positive. So flying through the air, reading people's thoughts, so doing all that sort of stuff. Yes, so what? You know, it's interesting, it's fun, and people like a bit of entertainment, but teaching Dhamma gives you happiness which lasts forever. They said that's the only psychic power which he really encourages to teaching.
Would it be a bit difficult if you were thinking in a different language? Or do they get the essence of what you're
Ah, it's interesting because you think first, or the mind moves first of all, and then it goes into language. You get the movement of the mind first, and the words come afterwards. So that when you're doing mind, for people who can actually read other people's thoughts, you read what's behind the words. So that's what you understand. So you don't actually read the language, you read the language of the mind, as they say. Which is, that's no language at all. So you could read anybody. So any of the Thai people here thinking in Thai, and the Singaporeans thinking in Chinese, any of the Sri Lankans thinking in Sinhala, yes, no protection for you.
Teaching the Dhamma as opposed to
formally
teaching the Dhamma. Could you
just
explain the difference?
Oh, it's just that if you have an ability to really teach and really get through to people, giving very different similes, ideas. Like Ajahn Chah was a great example. When he died, there was some monks. No, that's actually, it wasn't a monk, it was one of his chief lay disciples was interviewed on television at his funeral. And on the television, because Ajahn Chah was very famous in Thailand, they asked him, this disciple had been a disciple ever since he started, said, in all the years, have you ever seen Ajahn Chah show psychic power? Come on, you can tell us. It's on national TV. What have you seen him do? And this disciple said, I've seen Ajahn Chah teach the Dhamma. Is that the best psychic power? And look, even people coming from Western countries have come. Now that's a great psychic power, Ajahn Chah's ability to teach the Dhamma. And that lay disciple, when we monks heard that, we said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That lay disciple, all those years he's been with Ajahn Chah, has actually understood something. Because what they wanted on TV, have you seen him float through the air? Have you seen him move things through the air or do weird things, strange things? He said, no, the main thing is to be able to, teach the Dhamma. And that's why he was a famous monk, not because of his psychic powers, but because of his ability to teach and to encourage so many people, not just Westerners from overseas, but also many, many Thais, but to teach them the Dhamma, to heal their pain, their problems, to show them the way, to inspire them. And that was a great psychic power. It's also interesting, when the Buddha, just after he became enlightened, he went to actually teach these Kassapa brothers, 1,000 of them, 3 brothers. And he did all these psychic powers. And that didn't impress them at all. Well, it impressed them, but they said, that's really fantastic, that's wonderful, but it never really changed the way of looking at things. But then when the Buddha taught them the Dhamma, then they became disciples. The power of the Dhamma is much more important, much more powerful, the power of teaching and understanding. Than psychic powers. So psychic powers are just sort of fun and games, that's all.
We're talking about the Dhamma, and eventually people actually feeling it in their hearts as opposed to intellectually.
That's what I'm referring to, yes. You can actually read the Sutra of the Buddha, and you can actually read out the thought, but now the ability to impart the Dhamma. And you've got a great monk like Ajahn Mahabua, and you've got a monk like Ajahn Chah, and even Ajahn Mahabua said, Ajahn Chah, when it comes to teaching the Dhamma, it's much more powerful than I am. His power there was I don't know where he got it from over many lifetimes. He could put it in such easy words. So people from all nationalities could understand it. And even though he couldn't speak a word of English, Ajahn Chah, the only word of English he ever could say, he learned it after going with Ajahn Sumedho to England for the first time. And he learned one word of English. And that word of English was cup of tea.
Church's name.
That's the only word he learned. So his ability to teach Westerners was phenomenal. Okay, next question. Ajahn Brahm, can you please explain the 7 enlightenment factors? Wouldn't that be a nice topic for a talk soon? Yeah, so maybe tomorrow I wanted to talk about insight, and maybe can we leave that, what day is it today? Today's now day. The day after now day will be insight, so tomorrow morning. So the day after now day. We'll do this every enlightenment practice. Is that okay? Can we wait that long? Next question. Even after about 3 years of meditation, I am still at the inhaling and exhaling. You may be still at that stage, but where is your mind? If you let go of your I, and all this me doing this meditation, and measuring yourself and how good you are, how bad you are, all that conceit business, I am better, I am worse, I am the same. When you can leave your I at the inhale and exhale stage, and allow the mind just to go to jhanas. So, I do all your instructions, but do not go forward. No, you do not do all my instructions. Now I can tell you why. It says afterwards, please tell me what I must do. Now you know. All the doing. Doing, 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 doing. Please tell me what I must do, or is it the way I feel about it? Do you think I have gained any benefit by my practice? You gain a lot of benefit every time you get a little bit closer. But after a while, just, you know, to turn the non-doing switch. And it's worth it, even if it takes you your whole lifetime, or many, many lifetimes, actually to learn what letting go really is, and to do that for the first time. To really let go of this controlling and doing things. I agree with you, it's incredibly difficult. What you're doing in this retreat is one of the hardest retreats you could ever do. You may think it's simple. Oh, I can sleep, I don't have to these hours or that hours, and you know, it's nice and easy, but it's not, it's hard. And the reason it's hard is because I'm encouraging you to completely let go of this controller. Something you've been attached to, the real root attachment, which has been taking you from birth to birth, from suffering to suffering. And I'm just hammering again and again and again throughout this retreat on the same, one and the same teaching. You know, all these days so far, it's always been the same talk, the same thing on question and answers, in interviews. So let go of this doer. Stop controlling. Be content. Which means that you're not trying to make it different. This is good enough. You're giving, expecting nothing back in return. You don't want anything. You're letting go of the steering wheel, taking your feet off the pedals. You're just not controlling, you're not driving this vehicle anymore. You're listening, you're not talking. You're not giving orders. You're just being still and watching what's there. You're not making war with this moment, you're making peace with this moment. You're not doing anything. You're sitting on the Singapore Airlines, just watching, being a passenger. You're not the pilot anymore. All these things, all these ways of learning how just to let go, allow it to happen. And if you do that, you're just inhaling and exhaling, and you just really let go. The mind does it all by itself. You find that's where you make the progress. And you find that, a simile which I gave years ago, it's like you're walking up and down alongside this river. You've got to cross this river somehow. You're looking upwards, going up and down on the bank. The river is just one step wide. But when you go parallel to the river, up this way, down this way, up this way, down this way, you never cross that river. You just turn around and do it slightly differently than you've ever done it before. You're not going up, you're not going down, you're going across. You're going perpendicular to the way you usually walk. And then it's just one step and you're over. That's how close you are to the other side. And that just walking perpendicular instead of going up and down the same old way is not doing. Doing nothing, giving it up. We go doing, no, don't do, don't do, don't do. It's walking backwards. Doing, don't do. It's not doing. It's not doing, it's just giving up the whole thing about doing and walking perpendicular. Of allowing things to be, letting go, being still, just watching. All energy into mindfulness. But not reacting, not choosing. Just watching this and see what happens next. Don't care what happens next. Good or bad. Who's judging anyway? Who made those words? All you mentioned about words, they describe the truth, but they're only approximations to truth. You know, you say good and bad. Do you know what a good meditation is or a bad meditation is? What is a good meditation, a bad meditation? A lot of it we just impose this with our doing, controlling mind. One of the sayings which I quote quite often now, on the Wednesday afternoon, on the Saturday afternoon meditations once, during the question time, we used to have a basket there, and somebody put this really brilliant question that they wanted for me to comment on a quote from Lord Kelvin, who is one of the founders of actually engineering and technology. And the quote was from Lord Kelvin: before you can control the world, you have to learn how to measure it accurately. And technology is all about controlling. So we can actually, you know, control electricity, we can control the world. He said, but you've got to measure accurately first of all. And he saw that science had to have very, very good measuring equipment before technology could really start and evolve. And that was one of the first jobs of science, to measure precisely. But when he said, now what do you think about that, because I was a scientist before, I just turned it around. If you don't measure, there's no means of control anymore. You just lost control when you stop measuring. So, your meditation, is it good meditation or bad meditation? If you stop measuring it, control stops right there. You let go. Where we judge, this is not good enough, I want it to be better. Or you judge, I am better, I am worse, I am the same. And you start controlling from that point on. When you give up all sense of self, no judging, no measuring, no comparing, then what's there to do? You're all judging that I'm not enlightened, you think, I want to be enlightened. All judging and measuring, you're measuring your enlightenment to see how enlightened you are. Or measuring your meditation. Although you've been on meditation retreats before, is this your best meditation retreat? Now that's measuring again. You see what happens as soon as you start to measure it. Yeah, this is a good meditation retreat, you want to make it better. You've got 3 or 4 days to go, okay, let's really give it everything I've got. Because you're starting to measure. When there is a better or there's a worse, you've got business to do. If this is your worst meditation retreat ever, then of course when you measure, you really start to control. You know, I've only got 3 days to go, my goodness. Now people are going to ask me when I get, you know what happens when you go home? People ask you, how was it? And because you're on precept, you can't lie. So you really have to work hard. And because again, you're measuring again. When you go home, you can just say, how was it? Say, immeasurable. It's a really good word. Immeasurable. When it's immeasurable, you don't control it anymore. You let go. What's the difference between a bad meditation or a good meditation? I'll tell you what the difference is between a bad meditation and a good meditation. It's not what you're experiencing, it's how you regard it. Well, I said in that talk a couple of days ago, the relationship between you and your meditation, that's where you should do your work. It's not good meditation or bad meditation, you're regarding it in a silly way, you're judging it. And when you judge it, there has to be some work there. If you stop judging it, it's just meditation, that's all. You give expecting nothing back in return, you fully accept. By unconditional loving kindness doesn't judge the person. I will love you no matter who you are. You just stop judging them. When you've got a kid, you stop judging. They're just your kid, that's all right. They're all beautiful. It doesn't matter who they are, what they look like. Even if they've got 3 years, they're your kid, and they're beautiful. So this is actually what happens. When we have that love, there's no judging. There's no measuring. Therefore, there's no controlling. You're free. Now, do you understand what goes on here? When you say, I'm still only at the inhaling, exhaling stage, you're judging yourself, you're putting yourself down, you've been doing that all your life. And wherever you've got, I'm just exhaling, you know, I'm just on the basic stage. And I'm always basic, never get anywhere in life. Now, as soon as you keep measuring, you will never get anywhere in life. So stop all this measuring business. Just be in the moment, enjoy the moment, stop measuring it. It's not you, it's not yours. Enlightenment is, but not the person who enters it. So as long as you've got a person there, in my enlightenment, you can't get in, the door's locked. Okay, so that's a very easy way to meditate. Just stop measuring yourself and stop comparing. See if you can do that. Again, that's going perpendicular to everything you've ever done before. Everything is always being assessing. At the end of every school year, assess. You go class A, B, C or D, you know, pass or fail. When you go to work, you're always being assessed. If you're in sales, whether you're sort of your sales have gone up and gone down. Sort of, you know, the person who employs you assesses you. Even when you get married, your husband assesses you, your wife assesses you. If you don't pass, they trade you in for another model. But now you're in a retreat and you want to be assessed again. And I will not assess you. Please don't assess yourself. How enlightened are you? It's a silly question, isn't it? That's why I said the other day, remember that question? Am I enlightened? I said, he who knows isn't saying. Who says no? Now you know why. How can nimittas and jhanas help in understanding Dharma, e.g. basic foundations of Buddhism like the Four Noble Truths, Dukkha, Anicca, Anatta, etc. and help us to serve other human beings better? Oh my goodness. Nimittas and jhanas. First of all, when does a nimitta come up? Your body is gone. You know then your body can't be you. Your body is impermanent. It's non-self. The whole thing has disappeared. This thing you've been close to for all your life, and which you've been measuring all your life. Are you beautiful or are you ugly? Are you old? Are you young? And just measuring again. Are you skillful or are you not skillful? Are you fat or are you thin? You don't measure anymore. That's my excuse anyway for being fat. So all measuring I tell people is overweight business. So you have boundless, if you have boundless compassion, then you're going to get boundless, aren't you? That's what happens when you get boundless compassion. The door of my mouth is open to whatever you're doing. unconditional acceptance. What do you expect? Anyway. How they actually understand Dharma, especially the Four Noble Truths, the Third Noble Truth. When you get into a jhana, you've let go, you've got Sambodhisukha, the bliss of enlightenment, the Buddha said. So you actually understand where this bliss is coming from letting go. That's what the third noble truth is all about. Letting go leads to nibbana. And you've done that letting go. You really understand that third noble truth when you get a jhana. And you understand the second noble truth is why you don't get jhanas. Craving, craving, craving leads to suffering. You also understand, sort of, you know, the suffering of the body. First noble truth, this body, and these five senses are suffering, because when they disappear, you're blissing out. You understand the Eightfold Path, because the Eightfold Path culminates in jhana. So you actually understand from experience that eighth factor, what that really is, and how mindfulness contributes. Mindfulness going into the knowing, taking away from the doing. And then the jhanas happen. So you really get a very deep experiential understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And afterwards you see that some people don't experience jhanas, they write a lot of rubbish about the Four Noble Truths. So when you actually have experience, you get some really deep understandings. And how they help serve other beings better? First of all, you understand what you're talking about, so you understand what serving is. Remember I said yesterday about the young Boy Scout took the woman across the road because she never wanted to go anyway. He thought he was serving others, but because he wasn't wise, he actually created more problems than service. And we don't really know what we're doing, what happiness is anyway. We think that what we should really do to help other people is give them more money so they can actually have more material benefits, and we think they'll now be happy. And just, you know, doing the wrong way. So we should actually send meditation teachers to all parts of the world instead of aid, to actually get people have more people to have jhanas in the world, and then people will be happy, sort of. But then we know how we can really serve. Again, when we develop jhanas, we develop wisdom, we develop selflessness. When you have selflessness, compassion comes from there. Compassion comes from peace, from selflessness. The more self you have, the harder it is to be compassionate. I mean real compassion. To really open up your heart to somebody else. Any comments on that one? We go to the next one. Okay, the next question here. I can't seem to reconcile the teachings of non-self and karma. Now you can always see the problem there. I can't seem to reconcile. But your non-self can reconcile yourself with karma. As long as there's an I there, there's always going to be a problem. The Buddhist perspective of life is non-fatalistic, hence Ajahn Chah's favourite quote, the future is uncertain. So long as we consciously do good deeds, we can change our karma for the better. However, Ajahn has been saying, we have got no choice. And this, if I'm not mistaken, seems to suggest that all our actions are conditioned, and that there isn't a me involved in the decision-making process that leads to an action. Doesn't this become a fatalistic view? I must have missed something. Please kindly enlighten me. Thank you. You had no choice but to write that. No, it depends on which way you look at things. The way you look at things in this one perspective. Remember, just one perspective is not always the full perspective. You look at things backwards and forwards before you really understand something from different perspectives. The perspective which you really sort of point on, there is no choice in it. Really, there is choice. Choice is. You can see it happening all the time. Ainsley's just chosen to rub his nose. Now, I've just chosen just to say these words. You've chosen to listen. You can see choice happening. Choice is, but there is no chooser. It doesn't originate from you, is the point here. It's not a person inside who is at the controls of your body and mind. Now, that's the perspective. Choice is, but it does not come from you. It comes from all sorts of other things. And that's a whole talk on anatta, which I love doing. I'm not going to go into it in detail now, because the real full talk on anatta is scary. To find out that you don't exist after all these years of thinking you did. That you're not in control. That you've been brainwashed. And you've been brainwashed to a much greater degree than you ever expected. Which is why, when you go to the shops, you think that you're in full control which brand of muesli, or soy milk, or whatever you take. It really appears, to all intents and purposes, that you have free choice in the supermarket. If that was the case, there would be no money in advertising. When you go in that supermarket, it's already determined which product you're going to take. The advertisement's already decided that. But the way advertising and brainwashing works, if you don't realise, you cannot see that what you take to be your choice is being completely conditioned. Now, that's very fascinating. But to really understand that, say, where did this choice come from? Choice is... It doesn't come from you. There's no one in there. So where does it come from? It comes from so many different factors. So many different sort of parts. It's just a web. A whole web of influence which makes you do what you do now. And the fact that you can get into jhanas is because all the teachings you've been getting from me and from other monks. The fact you can become enlightened is because of other enlightened beings. And the reason they became enlightened was because their teachers. And the reason they became enlightened is the teachers of their teachers. And the reason why there's any enlightenment at all, or any Dharma being taught, is because of 2,600 years ago, Siddhartha Gautama sat under a Bodhi tree and became a Buddha. That's where the original cause of the possibility of enlightenment comes from. It's fascinating to see the whole chain of advertising. Starting from the great advertiser in Shastra Buddha. That's where the conditioning came from.
Then how do you link to karma then?
How do you link to karma? That karma is actually just a process of cause and effect. And you can actually see that process, that linkage. This happened because of what? And you can see sort of the cause making the effect, and the cause making the effect, the cause making the effect. And as soon as there's a perspective of a self, then there's a self. That perspective, that delusion, is one of the fundamental causes of karma, which is why when that delusion is obliterated, the arahats don't make rebirth producing karma anymore. For them, the karma is gone. You have to have the illusion of the self to really make that degree of karma. As the Buddha said in dependent origination, with the abolishing and ending, the cessation of avijja delusion, is the abolishing of the karma formations. Karma formations end as a result of avijja endings. So, as long as there's a sense of self there, there's karma. But that sense of self is gone. Delusion has ended for you. The arahat, the karma formations are stopped. Interesting, isn't it?
And then you need the effort.
You need the effort. Where did the effort come from? All the effort. Sometimes the effort is energy, but sometimes the energy goes in the wrong place. Effort without wisdom just misses the point. Right? You get people put huge amounts of effort into sort of like playing soccer or like, you know, training for the Olympic Games. My goodness, those people put forth more effort than I could ever do. They train. They push themselves to the very limit. But their effort is placed in the wrong place. And they don't get very far. I always remember this picture was in Time magazine. Of this, I think it was an American athlete. I think in the 400 meters. And she tripped in the final. And you could see the agony on her face. I don't know if you remember that, I think it was in the LA Olympics or something. And she, that's like Decker, Mary Decker, yeah. And she tripped, and she fell. And that's about 4 years of training, and 4 years of struggle, and it all came to nothing because of a wonderful accident. And the pain on her face was, oh, I've never seen so much suffering on a girl's face before. And 4 years of nothing. That's what happens in terminus, all that stuff of trying so hard. But if you put that sort of effort into knowing, into meditation, into letting go, wow, there'd be some great Olympic athletes in meditation here today. There'd be jhanas all over the place, arahats, people floating through the air earlier. So this is actually, that's where the effort comes from. Well, what is potent effort? Why do you put effort there? And why do you actually, where does effort come from? Effort usually comes from inspiration, motivation. And where does inspiration and motivation come from? It doesn't come from you. It comes from your teachers, your role models, people who have inspired you in life. That's where your effort comes from. External to you. You find you've got no choice. You don't become lazy, you've just got no choice but to put forth effort. You've got no choice in the matter. You have to strive. You can't not strive. Yeah?
I don't get what you mean by choice is.
You can see choice happening. So you can see choice happening, though it actually is, you can observe it. I can observe you over there, but I know there's nobody in there. A choice is, but no one actually does the choosing. We think that because of choice there must be somebody doing the choosing. It has to originate from a self, from a you, from a Jari. But there's no one in there. You are not in control. You think you are, and that's a great illusion. You know that story I say, I should really put all this in a talk on Anattā, can go on for all night. But one of the things which really shocked me was as a student while I was at Cambridge. I used to be part of the Psychic Research Society there. I still know the sort of the person as the president at the time. He had the distinction of, he had a business card. He was one of the professors at Cambridge. He had this business card which said, on the Ghost Hunting Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It's a great business card. He was one of the ghost hunters. And he became perhaps maybe the most famous ghost hunter, because every now and again you pick up a Sunday paper and some ghost haunting in England, and he's always the one who writes the article, he's the expert. And he's still a very close friend. And one every year on the lecture used to get a hypnotist to come and give a demonstration of hypnotism. And of course that was always really good fun. The first time he came, you know, you didn't really know what was going on. I volunteered, so if I could be a hypnotic subject, but I was hopeless, so I got sent back to the sea. And actually, in the end, it was quite a good job, because they'd always choose one who was really amenable to hypnosis, one student. Now, because you're a student, you didn't mind having a go and see what happens. And so this poor guy was put under hypnosis and made all sorts of stupid things. But the one thing which he was asked to do, in front of this whole sort of maybe about 100 students, to say, I'm going to give the hypnotic suggestion, and this is this, that when I touch my right earlobe, you'll stand up, doesn't matter what time it is or what's going on, when I touch my right earlobe, you'll stand up and sing the British National Anthem, God Save the Queen, in full voice. And he said, but don't do it now, it's only when I touch my earlobe, and now I'm going to take you out of trance in a few moments, you will not remember that instruction, but when I touch my earlobe, you stand up and you'll sing the British National Anthem. And of course, we'll all be looking at this and really interested. And then take him out of trance. He wouldn't remember what went on while he was in trance. He'd send him back to his seat. Thank you very much. And we couldn't wait. We weren't listening to what he was saying. We couldn't wait until his sort of hand moved his earlobe. And suddenly it did. He practiced it. And this poor student stood up in the middle of everybody and started singing, God's side. And it was hilarious. We cracked up. We couldn't stop laughing. And he wouldn't stop singing. He was just doing the whole God Save the Queen. And then when everyone calmed down, they'd ask this poor fellow, he wasn't at all embarrassed about doing this, they'd ask him, why did you do that? And he'd concoct some sort of reason. And the fascinating thing was that we all knew he was conditioned, he was forced to do that. But for him, it appeared exactly the same as if he'd willed it freely. There was no difference to his perception of free choice and what we knew, what 100 people had seen, had been a command made under hypnosis. And when I understood the meaning of that, again it sent shivers down my spine. How many things which I think I'm choosing to do are really my own free choice, and how much is being conditioned? Not by real hypnosis, but by culture, by school, by the talks which I was listening to. And after a while you see, 100%. That's scary. But in the end, there's nobody in there, so it's okay.
So that condition also, all of us.
Yeah, that's right, I've been doing that all week. Okay. We've got the hell here. I'll just finish off the question, but I think I've answered most of it. So long as we consciously do good deeds, we can change our karma for the better. However, Ajahn has been saying we have got no choice, and if I'm not mistaken, seems to suggest that all our actions are conditioned and there isn't a me involved in the decision-making process that leads to an action. Doesn't this become a fatalistic view? I must have missed something here. It's not a fatalistic view, because there's lots of conditions. And once you get on the road, once you're on the bus to Nirvana, you just can't get off. So a lot of you, I'm afraid, it's a bit too late already. Next question. Ajahn, would you tell us a little of the history of the two similar languages of Pali and Sanskrit? Sanskrit seems to be more well known, at least in the Western world today, and also understand associated with the Buddha, his words and writings, and also his birthplace of India. Okay, just a very quick. Sanskrit was the ancient language of the Vedas, that was pre-Buddhist, and just like any old classical language, by the time the Buddha started speaking, that it was based on Sanskrit, but it was like idiomatic Sanskrit. In the same way that much of English, you know, always gets abbreviated, elided, we sort of make up new words, complicated words get shortened. And because of that, the language changes. And so by the time the Buddha was around, he spoke a language which was very close to Pali, not Sanskrit, much more close to Pali than to Sanskrit. And by the time these things were written down, it was actually written down in Pali language, not Sanskrit. So the original Buddhist teachings, the earliest ones, were written in the Pali language, which was like a dialect of Sanskrit. There's not that much difference between Pali and Sanskrit. They're just slightly different. Like instead of like, what's a good word? If like jhana is jhana, they just spell it slightly differently. Still pronounce jhana, but instead of jh, they have a dhy, jhana. Instead of actually bodhisattva is in Pali, we have bodhisattva in sort of Sanskrit. So there's hardly any difference at all. Instead of Sariputta, Shariputta. Shariputra, with an extra R in there. So actually, Pali is much easier to say. Instead of saying Bodhisattva, Bodhisattva, you just take the V off. Instead of Shariputra, you have Sariputta. It's much easier to say. It's simplified. But then what happened later on, when the Mahayana Buddhists started, that time there was a fad, if you like, a fashion, for actually to put everything back in the, what was considered to be the more perfect language of Sanskrit. And so a lot of the Buddhist teachings were actually retranslated back into Sanskrit as like a classical, you know, old language.
Like Latin?
Like Latin, yeah. Even apparently that Winnie the Pooh was translated into Latin. The idea being that people thought that Buddhism was the perfect teaching, it should be in the perfect language, instead of something which had been modified, slightly simplified, slightly. And so there was a fashion of putting it into the older Sanskrit language. So we've got the situation where the older the teachings were in Pali, the older teachings were in a more modern language, the more modern teachings were in the older language. But that's actually where Pali and Sanskrit came from. There's hardly any difference between them. Once you know how to transfer from one to the other, it's very easy. Sorry.
Did Pali then originally end up, in the other days, in relationship to Hindi?
No, Hindi was even more more changed. So even more adapted. But it's still, every now and again, when I go to some of these interfaith things where they chant in Sanskrit or they chant in Punjabi. So many words you can recognize because they're all based on the same language. So Pali and Sanskrit is not that different. But because Theravada Buddhism, which is not the Pali language, you know, is only just growing in the West, now it's becoming much more known. So Pali is becoming more known.
Sanskrit and Pali both always spoken and written?
It was originally, yes. Especially Sanskrit was spoken, obviously, originally in the time of the Vedas. But then afterwards, when it became the language of the text, it became just a written language. And so when they started translating those texts back into Sanskrit, it was almost unintelligible to the ordinary people, and it was the language of the priests. They can understand it, ordinary people couldn't. Whereas in Pali, when the Buddha spoke Pali, everybody could understand it and could write it both. But nowadays it's become just a written language and very few people speak Pali. But the Buddha actually said, he made a very good point, he said the Dharma should be taught in the language of the common people. So we still keep the Pali as almost like the reference work, which hasn't changed, so we have a good idea of what that teaching was 25 centuries ago. But obviously you never don't teach in Pali. So if you teach in English, or you know, whatever language people actually speak in the place where you give the talks.
Ajahn, so why do we chant in Pali and then chant the loving hand in English? I mean, I can understand the loving hand in English so that we can understand the meaning. Then why do we
count
it in that way? That's number one. And number two, then why do we do the same for the
Well, it's because of like conditioning and choice. We have no choice. I can get away with a lot with that argument. No, it's, I think, because we had a reasonably good translation of the Metta Sutta, and that seems to work. We tried other types of translations, they don't seem to work. It is a matter of time, I suppose, until we get more translations. Anyway, next question. Ajahn, does our body heat increase when sitting in meditation? Thank you. Does your body heat increase when sitting in meditation? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It really depends on what you're doing. If you are thinking a lot and getting worried a lot, yes, it really does increase the heat. But no, sometimes it does get hotter simply because that you are not working so hard with your thinking. And energy has got more chance to go to the body sometimes. It's like an excess of energy just flows in the energy, flows to the body, get a bit warmer. That could happen. Sometimes, and this is really interesting if this happens to you, you get just areas of the body which get very, very warm and very hot when you're meditating, just like patches of heat. And if that happens, that's a really good sign, because that usually is the case, that the energies are going to an area of the body which needs a bit of healing. And that heat there is a sign that some good stuff is going on in that part of the body. And that happens really weird sometimes. You feel this patch in your body is really, really warm, and you don't know why. It's usually because there's some sort of disease or injury or something wrong there. The energies are going there and doing their job and healing you up. They're working. So that could be something which is happening. But a lot of the times that, you know, you just forget your body and you can't feel it heat, you can't feel it cold, you don't really feel it at all. And that's the best. You can do meditations where you can create heat in your body. That's what some of the Tibetan monks have to learn in order to survive in very, very cold places. And I always like those stories, because whenever anybody complains about the cold, I say, you don't know what cold is. Because these monks, while you develop that inner heat, they'd be tested. They'd be taken out in the middle of the winter, at night time in Tibet. You can imagine how cold that would be. Up in the Himalayas in the middle of the winter with the wind howling across the snow banks. They could wear their robes. So it wasn't that tough. But first, the robes would be dipped in the icy lake first before they wore them. So they'd be naked except a wet robe, which was probably the freezing temperature anyway. They could wrap that around them. And they sit there in the icy, snowy mountains. And they had to dry 7 robes in one night time to pass the test. With their body heat. So now, the next time you feel cold, just think about that. And think how lucky you are that in this retreat it's not being run by a Tibetan monk. Otherwise, you might send you outside and put all of your clothes and your blankets in water first of all, and then sit out there. I don't know, that's how stupid it is. Well, it's interesting that even though the Buddha kept on saying about Majjhima, the middle way, about not going to extremes, still always, like monastics, they always tend to sort of get into extra asceticism. And you know, lay people, actually, you encourage that. You say, oh, that's a really amazing monk. They can sit and they can dry 7 blankets a night time. And you go and offer dharma to them, and you give them a monastery and offer all your money to them, and think, oh, that's a really great monk. Or you get some monks that was really, really thin, and hardly ever eats, and just sits there without moving for hours and hours. Oh, that must be a really good monk.
But what happens
when
the monk has never made it,
isn't it? Then you came to Ravada monks. No, I don't know. Poor monks. Must get sort of hypothermia or something. Anyway, no, that's going into extremes, I agree with you. But sometimes it's easy that even you get into too much asceticism sometimes. You sort of decide, okay, only one day to go to before the retreat ends, I'm going to stay up all night. You push yourself and say, okay, I'm not going to get into this body, I'm going to take away my cushion, I'm going to sit on the hard floor, I'm not going to go against the wall. People get into that asceticism business. And they think that they're doing something, they're gaining something. It's all like sense of self again, ego. I am better than the other person. You know, it is spiritual materialism, which you've got to be very careful of. You know, the Theravadas, we're much better than those Tibetan monks. You know, it's like one-upmanship. It's all that spiritual materialism. There's no such thing like that. But it's very easy that we can get into that. You know, I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. Who's your teacher? No, he's nobody. And that's, you know, spiritual materialism. We should sort of get into that at all. It doesn't matter, you know, who you're a disciple of or what you're doing or whatever. So you don't judge yourself. There's no better, no worse, no the same. It's not measuring. And then all that sort of spiritual materialism business sort of disappears. And then also with that spiritual materialism, there's a chance you might be able to go in the middle way. Because you're not sort of trying to push yourself too hard. Thinking that if I push myself hard, I'll be better than the other people. I am much more ascetic. In the time of the Buddha, used to have these Jain ascetics. And they sometimes, say, you know, standing on one leg all day, you know, facing the sun. They would hardly ever eat. They're just like, and you know, sometimes people wanted the Buddha to do that. Same, you know, it's called keeping up with the Jainses. Did you not see that one coming? But we're not doing that, we're not trying to sort of keep up with anybody. Okay, next question. I now have so many vivid dreams which before I never did have, or even if I did, never remembered them. It's because of meditation, if so, why? Do you dream of horses in a race? What's the name of the horse? No. Sometimes vivid dreams is the fact you've got energy going in your mind. Which means that even when you're sleeping, there's lots of energy there, so the mind is seeing things. So sometimes it can be fun, but just don't really get into it too much. It can also be a case you are sleeping too much now. Because the most vivid dreams happen just before you awake, and it means that you should have been awake and up about sort of half an hour before. You had the energy, you really were awake, but you decided just to sleep a bit more. It doesn't really matter if it's vivid dreams. What's more important is actually whether they're vividly wonderful or they're vividly frightening. And if they're vividly positive dreams, and they're sort of good fun, they're enjoyable, they're peaceful, then that's really nice to have the good dreams. If they're frightening or sort of they're unpleasant, you know, then sort of it shows that the mind is not sort of pure, it's just sort of trying too hard. It's got too much anger, ill will or pain inside the mind. So usually what happens in a retreat like this, if you do get vivid dreams, they're just so nice and so wonderful. They're nice peaceful dreams, they're happy dreams, instead of being unpleasant ones. Okay, next question come out. Is there any comment on that one? Okay, next one. Actually, I never said whether it's vivid dreams while I was sleeping or whether they were meditating. I hope it was vivid dreams while you're sleeping. Not vivid dreams while you're meditating. Ajahn, what is the Buddhist view of the origin of mankind and the origin of the earth as opposed to the theological views by other religions? Okay. Actually, you know who the first astronaut was? Who was the first man in space?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah.
No. There's a monk called Rohitasa. In the suttas. He was actually a hermit. And he developed the psychic power of being able to fly through the air. So he decided he'd try and find out where the end of the universe is. So he just went off into space. Went off into places where human beings don't exist. Into the dark spaces between worlds, as it says in the suttas, where the light of the sun doesn't reach. He was the first astronaut. Buddhist. And he went for day after day after day, and he died on a journey without ever finding, no, years, without ever finding the end of the universe. And as a result, because he had obviously great powers, his rebirth was in the Deva realm. And of being reborn as a Deva, he still didn't know where the end of the universe was, so he came to see the Buddha and told him the story. And told him he'd travelled as this previous life so far, still didn't find the end of this universe. And the Buddha said, you stupid monk. So the end of the universe is not to be found out there. The end of the universe is to be found in its fathom-long body. That's where the beginning and the end of the universe is, inside of you. In the mind, you find the beginning and the end of all things. Beautiful teaching by the Buddha. But, nevertheless, people still say, well, where did this world come from? Well, usually the Buddhists have this idea that it's basically the Big Bang Theory, that the, what's it called, the evolution and involution of the universe, the expanding of the universe and the ending of the universe. Not just one, but many, 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 many universes. That's actually in the teachings of the Buddha, that he remembered 91, they call them like world cycles, like universes, universal systems. He said at the end, when all of the matter, the four elements, he called it, in this universe disappear, people get reborn in the realm of the mind. Because the mind is independent of the body, and you find this out when you're meditating, in deep meditation, the body just doesn't exist for you, but you still exist. You know that when you die, the body is gone, but the mind still carries on. The mind is independent of the body, independent of the earth, independent of the four elements. So when this universe finishes, your mind just carries on. So it's not all destroyed at the end of the universe. It's not all created at the beginning of this universe. The beginning of this universe, the four elements, earth, air, fire and water, you know, material stuff, that's created by natural causes. By physics, and that's having understood that physics as a student, understand that that gives by far the most reasonable explanation for the appearance of this universe, the external universe. But the mind was there before it, would be there afterwards, because the mind is independent of those material things. And if you get into really big memories of your rebirths, as the Buddha did, he remembered 91 eons, that includes 90 Big Bangs. So this is actually what happens. So the Buddhists have a much bigger picture than other religions. Most other religions just have one universe. And we have many universes, one after the other, going back incalculably. And the Buddha himself could only remember 91 of those eons. And in the meantime, when the material world is gone, the mind is still there. You know what I said yesterday about in ancient Greece, that the Greeks had six senses and Western civilization lost its mind, lost its common sense. And with it they became so materialistic, we think that once this universe started, then we started. That the idea of like a soul, a mind, a being started with the origin of this universe. Or even later on. But the mind was there before. Will be there after this universe goes. So, it's not really the creation of, you know, this universe, the matter, the planets, the solar systems, the galaxies, you know, the creation of like energy, dark matter, whatever else you want to include into this. But it's actually the creation of the mind, because that is the forerunner of all things, that's the main thing. To understand like the creation of the mind, it's like the evolution of that mind. You can see your evolution of your mind right now. Growing, changing, learning, brightening up as you go through life and learn from life's experiences. So that's actually the origin of things. And it is a far more reasonable explanation than the idea of like some original cause creating this one universe. And it's also said, if there was one universe, why can't there be two, three, 400? If there's one, there'll always be two. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. To have one, a single thing, is impossible in Islam. Where there's one, there has to be two. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Goes on and on and on. So there has been many universes. There will be many more universes. Universes come and universes go. Been here, done that. And after a while you think, how many more universes do you have to go to? huge picture. Yeah.
Does Brisbane have any thoughts on parallel universes?
Parallel universes, not so much. Well, it can have parallel universes, but even in science, you can't actually get from one parallel universe to another. So they're just completely separated. Can't. But they have like parallel world systems, yeah. With other. So there is only one sutta, one teaching of the Buddha. It's just hidden away in the Anguttara Nikaya, but it does, for all intents and purposes, say that ET exists. That there are other world systems with other beings in them. And so that's interesting, that's actually in there 26 centuries ago. But no, so far away, don't it? Doesn't say there's any communication possible at all. But mostly just dark spaces between them. It's a fascinating when they say that, that world systems, and they use the word like cycles, like world cycle systems. And you know, if you look at any galaxy, it's mostly the spiral galaxies. There's a few globular galaxies, but they're all like wheels. And actually, the Buddha using the word like a wheel for like a universe, like not a solar system, more like a world system. And that'd be amazingly accurate to what's actually there. Even it's amazingly accurate like, to the age of the universe as well, because I was a scientist, I was always interested in these things. And again, there's another sutra which. How you work it out is this, they say there's these different levels of deva realms, and the first level of heavenly beings above us is like the realm of the four great kings. And they say, if I remember correctly, that the realm of the four great kings, the heavenly beings there, they live for 100 celestial years, and every day of that celestial year is, I think, worth 100 human years. And the next realm, they live for 200 of their celestial years, and every day of their celestial years is worth 200 human years. So in each of these realms, it goes up by a factor of 4, I think it is. And so I was working out one day, just we get to the top of those realms, it's the realm of like the Brahma realm. And it says elsewhere, like a Brahma lasts the whole universe cycle, the whole eon. So you can actually work out the lifespan of a Brahma god, and that would be like the age of an eon. When I worked it out, it worked out 36,000 million years. And that's actually, for those of you who know science, that's a ballpark figure. That's actually reasonable. Because I think at the moment that most of theoretical physics, most astrophysics, sorry, say that I think the universe is about 14,000 million years old. So it'll be going for about 14,000 million years according to science. And the Buddha said the lifespan would be about 36,000 million. So just over a third of the way. Which is in the ballpark, it's in the right area. Fascinating sort of calculation to show that 26 centuries ago you can get a calculation which was reasonable. The age of the universe. Yeah?
Hi John, is stream of consciousness the mind?
Stream of consciousness is the mind, yes, it's another way of looking at the mind, calling it the stream of consciousness. Yeah? Yeah? All your individual minds. You've been here much longer than 14,000 million years. So if you really start thinking you're old, almost 70, that's 70 is nothing. You're many millions of years old. Thousands of millions of years old. So that's why the Buddha said these amazing things. He said, you have shed more blood when you've been injured or been executed than there's waters in the whole oceans. You have cried more tears because, you know, you've lost your job or, you know, your best friend's run away with your husband. That's happened to you so many times over the course of samsara. More tears than there's waters in the whole oceans. It's incalculable. Here's sort of the number of times you've been reborn in these great cycles, universal cycles without end. Fascinating idea. It just really sort of blows the mind sometimes. the conception of time in Buddhism is just endless. It's vast.
So what's the relevance of rebirth if there's been so many rebirths? Like, why would one be more relevant than another? If there's just that many rebirths that the Buddha described, why is there such an emphasis on looking at past lives?
First of all, the emphasis is actually to understand there is a past life. That, you know, these things which you say are just not idle fancies, so these are truths which you can actually prove for yourself. We want to know for sure. It's okay Ajahn Brahm coming up here and saying, yeah, rebirth is, or reading in the ancient text the Buddha said, yes, rebirth is. You have been reborn before. Or getting someone else and say, yeah, I remember my rebirth and I can tell you who I was. That might interest you. And you might get all these books, like the ones written by Ian Stevenson, giving really hard evidence. But that still doesn't convince you. But when you get into deep meditation and you remember your own past life, then you're convinced. And it's for that reason that you'll change your perspective on what life is all about to remember your previous lives. That's why I encourage it. Just one is enough. You don't need to go back eons and eons and eons. Just one. So you say, yes, rebirth it.
So the real agenda for that is actually to establish the validity of leading moral life.
Leading moral life, there is rebirth, and it gives you the full picture for the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Without rebirth, Four Noble Truths, suffering. What do you mean suffering? I'm having a good time. Yeah, but what's coming next? You need a bigger picture actually to get the idea of suffering.
So it's not hugely relevant whether you remember one past life when I was the chief, you know, washer up for the Pharaoh and,
yeah,
and or, you know, the American Indian somewhere. That doesn't matter which one you
remember. Which one as long as it's just one. And you always remember just an ordinary Joe. You're not sort of in the Pharaoh's household or anyone else. This is just real past life, not those fancy ones. Okay, let's go to the next question. When you're about to die and get reborn somewhere, what is the thing that makes the connection between these two? Other religions believe that it is a soul which transfers, but we Buddhists don't believe in soul stuff. Would you please make clear? Okay. But these days, you can look upon it as a soul if you really want to, because it gives you an idea of what goes on. The only difference is that soul in Buddhism is not a permanent identity which never changes. It's a flux, it's a stream of consciousness. However, that if you don't look at it clearly enough, yeah, you'll see it's a soul, it's a being, it's a me. For most of people, if they recall their past lives, they can see themselves going over from one life to another in the same way that you've gone over from one day to the next in this retreat. When you go to bed at night and you wake up in the morning, it's you again. At least that's what it looks like. But if you look much more clearly, you've gone to sleep as one person, you've come awake as another person. You've changed slightly. You've mutated in your wisdom. And this is actually shows that you are changing. However, if you don't look carefully, it looks as if you're pretty much the same. And that's where we get the idea of a soul. On the outside, yeah, it seems that it's us again, but it seems there's something going across from one life to another. If you look more clearly, you see it is a process. And the difference is important, because it was one thing which went from life to life to life to life, and there's no end. There's something there that's indestructible. To see it come and go, rise and change with no essence there means it can cease. And that's the difference there. That was a great insight of the Buddha. But that comes with anatta later on. Okay, I think that answers that question. But when we do an anatta talk in a couple of days, we'll go even deeper into that.
You talk when you do that on, you know, the Buddha's image of the veins.
Yeah, okay, you can remind me of that. Here's a question here. Dear Ajahn, as you keep saying to let go, be contented, always say that's good enough. Suddenly I remembered one thing. As I know about the life history of the Lord of the Dhamma, the Buddha, before he got enlightened under the Bodhi tree, he made his determination. He had a resolution like, although the blood of my body dries up, I've become just bony. I'll not wake up of this something unless I get from this seat, this cushion, unless I get enlightenment. So the question is, isn't that tough? Isn't that expectation? Isn't that demanding? If not, then what is that? Whatever it is, eventually got enlightened afterwards. Okay, and that's true. Remember, this was before he became enlightened. And he made this earth-shattering resolution. Even though my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up, I will not move from this seat until I get complete and utter enlightenment. Isn't that stirring? Stirred me when I first heard it. It was my first WASAC as an 18-year-old student at Cambridge. I'd already been meditating for about 3 months. I could manage 20 minutes, 25 at a push. And when I heard that, I was so inspired. I went back to my room. I did that. It's actually a stupid young man, because I was in a rush to get in line. I had many other things to do in my life. And I sat down and I made this resolution. I said, if the Buddha could do it, so could I. Even though my bones turn to dust, my blood dries up, I'm not going to get up from my... Well, it's actually just a cushion on top of one of the armchairs. I took it off and put it on the floor. I'm not going to get up from my armchair cushion unless I get real full enlightenment. I think I lasted 40 minutes. By 40 minutes, I was in just such great pain. And of course, I opened my eyes, I wasn't enlightened, and even worse, my blood hadn't dried up yet. They were still there. So I couldn't stand it any longer.
Can we go back to when they first voted?
So it is sometimes we try these things. The Buddha had some great powers, but he had to let that go as well. And that resolution, that sometimes we make that resolution, but can you really do it? You don't know what you're doing. You make those resolutions, but it all comes from ego and self. I want to become enlightened. I can do it. I'm not going to move. This is it. An enlightenment or bust. The great Ananda tried that one. Personal disciple. Last day, I told that story the other day. 500 people invited to the first council, 499 were arahats. He wasn't. He tried his very best. He really put forth effort, and this was a great monk in the time of the Buddha. The Buddha's attendant for so many years. He couldn't do it, but as soon as he let go, and before his head hit the pillow, then he was enlightened. So tonight, in a few moments, Mother Lisa, you can try the Ananda meditation method. There's actually one more question. Oh, goodness, this is actually a hole. Is this? Okay, I'll leave this one till tomorrow because it's a long one. It's already getting quite late, so I hope you don't mind because it's a very, very long one. So I'll leave this one till tomorrow. So, because now I want you all to try the Ananda enlightenment. It's not the Ananda enlightenment method, to carry on meditating. But don't make those great resolutions, even though my bones turn to dust. Because I don't want you to sort of get into great pain and sue the Buddhist Society of Western Australia for you to have to leave this retreat in a wheelchair. We can't afford it. So take it easy, be soft, be kind. That is the fastest way. You're letting go, being at peace, enjoying yourself, and that the Buddha found. Remember, just after he became enlightened, the Buddha went to see his 5 monks and they said, "You're a slacker." They said, "You've given up the tough part." And his first 5 disciples didn't believe you can get enlightened by doing this soft part of the Buddha practice, by eating properly and taking it easy. And it took a lot of persuasion for the Buddha to say, "This is the path, the middle way." Because most people thought asceticism was the way. And so remember those experiences. It's a soft way. And you feel it's the right way. Because you get peaceful, you get happy, you get free. You realize, you should be able to realize by now that this is the way to enlightenment. Especially when you understand that enlightenment is the highest, the ultimate happiness. Nibbana Paramang Sukham. That's Pali. Nibbana. This is Sanskrit Nirvana, Nibbana in Pali. Paramang, like paramount. Now that's